Mississippi's had some pretty strange senators in the past.
Well, let's see. There was Jim Eastland, and he used to get big tax deductions. He used to get paid for not raising cotton in Mississippi, and he had a huge cotton plantation in Mexico.
Oh, really? No, before that, there was a Senator Bilbo. This goes quite a ways back.
That was before my time.
Well, he was, I vaguely remember him when I was a kid. He was he was bad news.
They're all the vestiges of the plantation owners. I mean, they have it.
Are you there still? Whoop, have we lost our caller?
Yes.
I guess we have. Well, a very interesting call, bringing back lots of things to think about. We have a kind of an industrial process that seems to be heading us into deep trouble. We depend for our prosperity on mineral resources that are have a limited lifespan, and just some of them, like oil, according to one report, has enough for there's enough oil left for 46 years at the current rate of production. And of course, oil, the more we use, the more damage it does to the environment. Then there's natural gas, there's enough of that for 58 years. There are rare earth elements, which could be gone in 20 years. Right now, China supplies about 97% of these rare earth elements. And there is apparently there's a shortage of sand, which combined with the cement is what makes concrete. And all this this mining and processing uses a huge amounts of water, which is not which is a limited supply of clean drinking water. Well, I think I hear my music, so it's time for this show to end. I hope I've given people something to think about and something to join with others to combat the
KBOO Portland
kind of,
on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
I'm Wendy Ring.
And I'm Brian Curtis. Welcome to Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up.
We are usually all about success and victories on this show, but in the spirit of Eleanor Roosevelt, who said, "Learn from the mistakes of others. You can't live long enough to make them all yourself," our story this time is about a failure. Not a total unmitigated failure, more like a caterpillar on the way to becoming a butterfly. It's the story of how a popular program in San Francisco that we covered in a previous episode did not succeed when applied across the bay in a very different community. It's also an object lesson in the difference between equity and equality. Warren Logan works for the mayor of Oakland as the policy director of mobility and interagency relations. In April 2020, he found himself in the hot seat. It started with the best of intentions, early in the COVID pandemic.
There were two challenges we needed to address. One was that people who are still driving, they might drive faster in our local neighborhoods. And in fact, we've seen that to be the case. And we grew incredibly worried that we would actually see more collisions that led to injury in the same places that we knew were already dangerous. So that was issue one. The second issue we were trying to grapple with was, how do we give our neighborhoods some space? Oakland, a lot of people live in apartment buildings. We wanted to make sure that folks had ample room to still bounce a ball or run or jog or bicycle around and feel safe doing so.
The mayor's office was also under some political pressure.
Right before the pandemic, the city experienced three very high profile fatal collisions at school crosswalks that involved very young children and their parents. And so understandably, we had a number of East Oakland neighborhoods saying, why is it that we can't even cross the street to pick up our kids without dying? And what are you, mayor's office, DOT, City of Oakland, what are you gonna do to fix this now? We want to see action today. So both the mayor, myself, and the DOT director felt so strongly to take a big leap forward and say, you know what? We just passed this revolutionary bicycle safety plan, and we took that map and made slow streets. It was basically a rebranding.
Let's stop here and talk about this revolutionary bicycle plan. Bicycle planning has traditionally been dominated by white male planners and white male cycling advocates. The result is profound inequity in the location and design of cycling infrastructure. In developing its bicycle plan, called Let's Bike Oakland, the city worked to deliberately undo this legacy by focusing investment in East and West Oakland, areas with the highest proportion of Black, Brown, and low-income residents.
They contracted with local community organizations to solicit community input, including three rounds of listening sessions and over 20 mobile community workshops. The resulting plan was a network of low-stress bike routes, combining protected bike lanes with shared low-traffic streets selected by local residents. When complete, over 80% of Oaklanders in these disadvantaged communities will have a safe 10-minute bike ride to grocery stores, shopping districts, schools, libraries, and recreation centers. This equity-driven process won a National Achievement Award from the American Planning Association.
So what Oakland was going to do in response to the pandemic was take those low-stress streets that were planned for the future and make them happen now.
We were going to close 74 miles of our roadway to through traffic.
This was, at the time, the biggest pandemic street closure in the country. The mayor's announcement got national and even international press. Within 48 hours, plastic A-frame barriers started appearing on city streets.
The barriers blocked off half the street at intersections, decreasing the area for cars to enter. Residents, as well as delivery and emergency vehicles, could still drive around the barriers to get in, but signs asked others not to drive through. There was no police enforcement, just the honor system.
This rapid implementation of Let's Bike Oakland did what it was originally intended to do, creating safer bike routes through the city.
I had a number of meetings during COVID where I had to get across the city and I didn't own a car. So I actually was able to use a lot of our slow streets combined with our network of bike lanes to bike damn near across the entire city, which turns out with a lot fewer cars on the road is very easy to do. And the initial feedback was great.
Then the phone calls began.
There were people who called my office and said that I, a Black man who lives in Oakland, was trying to trick Black people into catching COVID by creating the Slow Streets program. You're trying to encourage my landlord to kick me out of my house. I don't even think my staff fully understood, and I didn't even understand to some degree too, that something as simple as a plastic sign would cause people so much anger.
It's been more than a year, and you can hear in his voice that those accusations still hurt.
I have feelings.
Keita Price is the director of urban and regional planning for the East Oakland Collective.
And the third generation, deep East Oakland native. It's hard because we're talking virtually, but if you center yourself as downtown, Lake Merritt is right next to downtown. And then after Lake Merritt, everything east of Lake Merritt, the city considers East Oakland. Central East Oakland is Fruitvale, heavily populated by the Latinx community. And when you go further east, most east, we call it deep east, past Fruitvale, then that's where you get the neighborhoods such as mine. My family originally came over here from Memphis and other parts of the South Texas for the Navy, but other folks came just for a better quality of life from stuff that was going on in the South. My great-grandma was one of the first Black folks to obtain property in East Oakland, which is why I'm so proud to be here.
As a young woman, Keita aspired to a career as a professional basketball player and was hedging her bets with a major in chemistry at Merritt College when seeing the impacts of gentrification firsthand motivated her to become an urban planner instead. Part of her role at the East Oakland Collective has been collaborating with the city's Department of Transportation to develop an East Oakland Mobility Action Plan.
The East Oakland Collective was one of the community groups which designed and carried out the public engagement process for the bike plan, so they knew what was in it.
But the rollout of slow streets took them by surprise.
I came to know about slow streets by seeing it on my street. I just saw streets blocked off with no adequate signage of what this is. Some of them didn't even say slow street, and some of it did say slow street, but I mean, who knows what this terminology is? I work with the Department of Transportation very, very closely, and we was not informed that this was going on. And so as a resident just walking around, I was kind of surprised and just like, what is this?
Once she figured it out,
I just did an impromptu social media video on Instagram showing people what slow streets is and explaining you're supposed to be able to walk down these streets socially distant without cars coming through. The cars don't really know and understand what this blocked off space is. They don't see anybody in there, and there's no signage on why it's blocked off. So as I'm doing the video, supposed to be walking freely in the middle of the street that's blocked off, a car hit the corner, you feel me, and almost hit me. It is on camera.
Thankfully, there were no kids playing in the street.
Nobody in the hood in this area was out playing. I'm 34. We ain't safely played out in the streets of East Oakland since I was 13. That's when the question comes to who is this slow streets really for? Because it was thriving in the higher income and privileged communities where the stay-at-home moms and dads got to use that extra space to take their kids out, be active or whatever. But yeah, it just wasn't as realistic here.
On closer examination, that initial wave of enthusiastic feedback about slow streets came from online survey respondents whose demographics were twice as white and twice as wealthy as the city's general population.
The hills or semi-hills folks are privileged or aware to take these type of surveys, whereas the disadvantaged, low-income, busy, hustle and bustle folks in the flatlands are, you know, busy thriving and surviving. They're not really plugged into these things.
Especially in a neighborhood full of essential workers, where COVID was hitting twice as hard as in other parts of the city. The community's reaction wasn't a polite, no thanks. It was hell no.
Going from 0 to 100 that quickly is not about the slow streets program and everything to do with affordable housing and white supremacy and cultural and historic trauma that people have felt for multiple generations at this point.
Transportation planners and Black Oaklanders have a history.
Oaklanders know what it was like to see freeways rip through their communities in Black and brown neighborhoods.
Many of the people who lost their homes when the freeway was punched through Black West Oakland ended up in East Oakland, and now in one of the fastest gentrifying cities in the U.S., they and their descendants are being displaced again.
Rents have doubled over the last decade, pushing Black and brown people out. In 1980, 50% of Oakland residents were African American. Now that proportion is down to 25%, and some of them are living on the street.
There's this concern then that any investment, that if I repave the road, if I extend the sidewalks, if I add stoplights, that that is also a form of gentrification, a potential for displacement.
Brittany Brown is an urban transportation planner who centers the healing of racialized people in her work. She grew up on the border between two neighborhoods.
I grew up on the corner of 65th and San Pablo, where my great-grandparents bought their first home, coming from Texas in the 40s. And depending on what side of the street you were, you know, you could cross the street and be in Emeryville and cross the street and be in Oakland. You could see what neighborhood you were in based on the condition of the streets, the trees, and just the small things. I noticed that as a young person, just walking to school, walking to the movies with friends, and then discovered urban planning when I was at UC Berkeley in my third year. Just literally walked up to the College of Environmental Design and was like, what is this building? I was studying African American studies at the time and just had a lot of rage around what had happened historically to Black folks globally and in the United States, and saw urban planning as a tool for freedom and change. I'm really grateful and appreciative of all the Black women who have really inspired me and lifted me up. And my mom and my grandmother, seeing how they've navigated the built environment even when it wasn't set up for them. And so they are my blueprint, and they are true innovation for me. The built environment really reinforces the trauma that Black and brown folks experience on a daily basis. And I think transportation can either support the healing and create opportunities, or it can exacerbate things.
Brittany says barricades may remind East Oaklanders of their construction experience with bus rapid transit.
Deep East Oakland was the most impacted by that construction. I was living in East Oakland at that time, and I remember how affected my movement was throughout the corridor. The impacts of construction have caused a lot of harm for our communities. And so what does it look like when you remove access? For one person, closing down a street could make it feel safe, could make you feel like you have access. But to another person or another community, it's a reminder of a time when they were denied access for a construction project that took 5 years when it only took 1 year in another part of the city. We don't think about those kinds of things. We don't think about community triggers and trauma and stress. And that's that critical harm reduction piece that I think gets left out of the conversation.
Plastic barriers can not only be a trigger, they can also look like an inadequate response to life-threatening problems. Going back to the beginning of this story, Warren talked about the worry that speeding would increase accidents on the city's most dangerous streets. Well, many of those streets are in East Oakland.
When you look at where are low-income and people of color living, it is also where the greatest number of fatal collisions of people walking and bicycling and even driving happen. It's the same locations, the same intersections, the same major corridors, and it's wildly inequitable that we are not addressing, and by we, I mean both the city at large, the state, and even just the country in general, is a different epidemic. The number of people who die on our streets every day just because they keep getting hit by cars. And so it is no surprise that when you align the redlining maps with where do Black and brown people live and where is their poverty and where is their homelessness and where is their lack of investment, it's all the same neighborhoods. And so it compounds.
Affluent neighborhoods may only need a barricade because they already have what East Oakland lacks.
You talk to anybody in East Oakland, they will most likely tell you that their number one issue with streets is potholes. Potholes and poor paving and sidewalks when it comes to safety and just financial burden on people always having to fix their vehicles. The quality of our public transit, our Coliseum BART station in comparison to the BART stations in other higher income neighborhoods, you can just see and feel the difference.
Oakland is a port city, and the highway that runs through East Oakland carries all the heavy truck traffic.
Historically, the residents of the Hills had advocated for trucks not to be on 580, which creates a higher burden of pollution and toxicity for all the Black and brown communities. So we've been taking that heavy burden. Another big injustice that we have around transportation is driving while Black on any mode. We have young Black men who are well-known bike advocates and mentors who still this day get pulled over while on bikes, all because he's riding with a hoodie and he has locks. I don't have a car today still, just from being harassed by police, assuming that I have some kind of contraband in the car. So it's a risk. Driving, walking, biking while Black.
None of these major problems, which the community has been asking the city to solve for decades, will be fixed by slow streets.
People are tired of other values being inscribed into the built environment. And so I think for me, the idea of banning cars and making streets slow or closed or open or activated is a very white and privileged concept. We want to see our communities improve, absolutely. But I think we want solutions that we've asked for. The transportation field is dominated by white men, and there's a cultural mismatch. Quite simply, it takes a level of humility.
Instead of making plans for cars or bicycles, Brittany says we should center our planning on people.
A lot of Black and brown planners take a more holistic and collaborative approach. I'm co-editor at The Intersections. We're on Medium, a group of Black and brown women transportation planners and urban planners around the country. All of us in our work had that radical praxis of starting with people and then developing transportation solutions based on their lived experiences. We're not really interested in any one mode as the answer to all of our problems. We're really interested in the mobility of people. And so we don't ban cars because we know that cars are very much needed for folks who don't have access to transit, or it's unsafe, it's not reliable. They have lives that require them to get groceries across town because that's the most affordable option. Their families have been displaced to Stockton, so they need a car to continue those connections. Having a bike and being able to walk to all of the things that you need is a privilege. And I think people take that for granted. That is their life, and they want to inscribe their life onto other folks. I just wish we'd spend some more time and have some more respect for communities.
Even if the bike plan was a model of equitable participatory planning, its sudden and unilateral application felt like a return to the planning department's old way of doing things.
It's how you do, not what you do. We all want safer, better, and cleaner neighborhoods, but the issue is the process, having people that's actually from their part of the process, not top-down process. Just because somewhere in a plan that you work with community, an idea is written, you still have to do further engagement with the community before implementing that concept or idea. Instead of just trying to co-sign it based off of the plan, circle back to us and see how we should do this. I know we had to all act and think fast, but we could have got on an emergency call. We're here. It's not like you don't know us.
So here's a question. Who should call who? Warren said,
a number of the advocates that were very upset with me early on in this program, why didn't you call us? I'm so upset. You know, this is just like the city. And it's like, all of you have my cell phone number. You know how to reach me.
But there's a power imbalance that community folks feel keenly.
We've been having block parties forever, but you haven't seen a block party in East Oakland. You probably see one every blue moon for the past 3-4 years. But now you got open streets and you got all of it. Like, I don't know. It just becomes
like you're gonna close my street off. Why can't I close my street off?
Right. But I got to pay and I got to go through this long process. But you can just block it off anytime you want. The community just feel like the city do whatever the hell they want, when they want. And implementing the social streets the way they did, especially in East Oakland, just further proved to the community that, yeah, there's no trust there. Like, they don't trust the city to have their best interests.
So the Slow Streets program hit this big bump.
And what we really told the city is to just stop. Just stop implementation in East Oakland altogether right now until we figure some stuff out.
And they did. The city came up with more ways to hear from East Oaklanders. They met regularly with community groups like KITAS. They put their contact information on the street barricades.
On the back of each one, we posted, like, here's how to get feedback. Here's the email. Here's my contact information. We distributed surveys to every resident along every street in East Oakland and asked them, do you want us to keep moving forward and make this stronger? Do you want to leave it as it is? Or do you want us to just pack it up and go? And the feedback we've heard, pretty loud and clear, actually, was, we were upset, but not because you were trying to make our street safer. We were upset that this is not strong enough to address the issue. So a lot of our efforts were not just to address the challenges of slow streets, but to really continue an ongoing conversation with groups of people who had never trusted the government.
What East Oakland residents said they really needed was a safe way to cross dangerous streets to access food and healthcare. So instead of rolling out planned slow streets in East Oakland, the city created a new program, Essential Places, to improve crossings at intersections so people could safely reach clinics, grocery stores, food distribution locations, and COVID testing and vaccination sites.
When someone says, I'm concerned this intersection's dangerous, start with something simple and iteratively design improvements along the way. The Essential Places started with orange cones. We upgraded to soft hit posts, which are kind of the floppy posts that you can install really quickly. By the end, we were putting in almost hard bollards. So the design changed month to month. And that was the kind of exciting part, is for us to go back to the community groups that we were working with to say, okay, well, last week we just designed this one. We implemented it. Let us know what you think next week. We would come back again and say, okay, that didn't quite work. So for the next one, let's do it this way and see how that goes.
The result is 20 safer intersections in East Oakland's high-injury corridors.
And a new way for communities and the city to work together.
Slow Streets gave people the opportunity to literally look at something on the ground, as simple as a $20 sign that says, don't drive here, and have a concrete conversation about what safety should look like in their neighborhood. I remember a conversation I had with some of our major detractors that said, I want to get rid of this program. And I said, great, pick up the sign and put it to the side. It's that simple. And then they said, well, I don't want to do that. I don't think the sign's in the right spot. I'm like, now we're having a conversation about design. I don't think that the people were able to have that conversation until we were putting something physically out there on the road that they could move, like furniture in your house. I want to try putting the chair over here by the window. Nope, that didn't work. Let's put the sofa there. Let's each month, each week, even each day sometimes, move things around carefully to see if we're having an impact. We can do these types of pilots very cheaply. We might have spent $150,000 for a whole year. That's pennies pinched together in between budgets.
To be fair, what isn't being counted is all the unpaid work that community organizations had to do to get this program on the right track.
We had to redirect our attention from our East Oakland Mobility Action Plan work to now work with the Black Culture Zone, Just Cities, and some other individuals from East Oakland that really took issue to how Slow Streets was implemented. Again, unpaid, we had weekly calls with them to troubleshoot what was going on. We distributed the surveys and other things as we could and talked to residents about it.
Despite COVID-induced speeding, East Oakland's slow streets and essential places had zero cyclist and pedestrian injuries. In places where they were successful, the temporary barriers will be replaced by permanent installations.
What we're going to start seeing is these $20 million capital improvements for roads in East Oakland.
These will save lives for years to come.
What should also be permanent is the city's ability to respond to emergencies like they are emergencies. It should not take 10 years to plan one street at a time to respond to traffic fatalities that happen every damn day at this rate. That is the part that we are both capable of and really do mean that we want to. And I've already started seeing that shift in the way people think about traffic safety. It is so exciting to see the community really rally around that, to address safety seriously, expeditiously, and equitably.
Oakland Slow Streets program started off on the wrong foot.
The experience was just a nasty taste in our mouth. We didn't ask for it, they just did it. And even though we tried to troubleshoot as much as possible, I would say it was unsuccessful in East Oakland.
East Oakland Collective were mutual aid providers during COVID-19. And I wonder what a program would have looked like if it started with asking those kinds of organizations what they needed.
It would have been better to get things right from the get-go, but beyond safer intersections in East Oakland, this journey led to valuable lessons that will pay off in the future, there and elsewhere. For one,
put these community groups in the driver's seat. I think that that lesson cannot be learned more.
And if you're going to rearrange the furniture, do it with the people who live there, not to them.
I think it's been a really meaningful experience. There's so much more room to grow from here. We now understand just how deep some of the trauma is. We've already started talking about rethinking our communications teams. Instead of just hiring traditional urban planners, maybe we bring in anthropologists, maybe we bring in trauma specialists. We're going to look back on this past year and say, we changed the way people talk about traffic safety, what people expect from both engagement and their local government officials, and what types of improvements they can ask for on a regular basis. It's so exciting to see the community rally around that. That's how urban design should work. And we are finally getting to that place.
So that's the story of where we've been. Brittany shares her vision of where we can go from here.
My vision is for Black and brown people to see themselves, see their lived experiences, see their culture in the built environment, to have that culture and those experiences sanctioned by the government, legitimized, recognized as policy. I want to see spaces that make people feel joyful and have a deep pride. I'm really looking forward to see how we can bring all of our ideas together to make a city that is radically inclusive and free.
I'm Brian Curtis.
I'm Wendy Ring, and you've been listening to Cool Solutions, Stories of Climate Action from the Bottom Up. Thanks to our guests, Warren Logan, Keita Price, and Brittany Brown, and to Scott Holmes, Paul Caesar, and Ketza for our music. And now, a request.
We need your help, and it's not your money. Like a lot of the actions we take about climate, after 3 years of producing Cool Solutions, we're kind of wondering if what we do matters. We'd like to know what you think.
If you've shared one of our stories, been inspired to take action, or just felt buoyed by a ray of hope in the flood of bad news, please send us an email and let us know. Send it to Wendy, W-E-N-D-Y, at climate911.org. That's Wendy at climate911.org. And thanks for listening.
It's a KBOO Portland, Full Strength Community Radio. This is Kabaka Pyramid representing from Kingston, Jamaica. Baby Rock family, you don't know.
Want an impactful way to volunteer for KBOO? Believe in KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression.